in order for them to have their desired effect. And those five are faith, effort, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. So those of you who know, have some grounding in Buddha Dharma, know a bit about, you know, the Buddha's teachings of the sort of the reality or the existence of suffering, especially self-induced suffering of the mind, what brings it about, how it can be brought to cessation, and the means by which one does so. The means are this Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path consists of like three sections: the meditative factors, the wisdom factors, and the fruition factors, or the living in harmony with factors, sometimes also referred to as the morality or ethics. So the meditative factors are concentration, effort, and mindfulness. The wisdom factors are basically cultivation of insight into how things are and why, including how we are, all the causes and conditions that gave rise to who we are up to this moment in time. Insight into intentions, which is insight into all the causes and conditions that are going to go together to decide who we're going to be in the next moment. And then the fruition of intention in the form of speech and action and way of life. So of those five spiritual faculties, you see that all but one of them is already embedded within the Dharma wheel. Okay. The effort and the concentration, the mindfulness are all there in the meditative factors, and then in Panya, the wisdom factors, you know, we find this other faculty that arises. They arise quite naturally and they're reinforcing. Okay. So it's not like first you do one and then you do the other. So in this presentation tonight, I'm gonna, first time we were together going over these teachings, I just focused on the faith element, also called absolute trust or trust in mind. And for the rest of our time together tonight, I wanna talk about faith in relationship to effort and in relationship to concentration. And then when we next get together, 2 weeks from now, toward the end of the month, I'm going to talk about faith in relationship to mindfulness and faith in relationship to the wisdom factors. So that way we will have sort of pretty much covered the board. So in the Buddha's teachings on how one comes to the Dharma in the first place, how it is you happen to find yourself sitting here in your chair tonight or on your bench, what brought you here, he talked about a motivational force, okay, that the word is samvega in the Pali, and it's variously translated as urgency or motive force, sometimes it's anxiety. And the sense of samvega or urgency or fear or anxiety or whatever arise when it begins to dawn on you that the Buddha may have been right. It's like, you know, if I really have a look at what the mind's up to here, it's mostly all about attachment, aversion, and delusion, you know. It seemed to be pretty much programmed to seek out that which I want, avoid that which I don't want, ignore everything else. And then arises the question, and how's that working for you? And it occurs to you, maybe not so well. You know? Maybe this kind of prime directive of the self, you know, seek pleasure, avoid pain, live forever, has got some flaws in the software. You know, maybe that's not going to really be such a great guidance system going forward. Because unfortunately, it is not capable of addressing things like aging, infirmity, and death, right? These inevitabilities that arise. And so the sense of samvega arises when it's like, oh yeah, aging, infirmity, and death. The ego's prime directive doesn't seem very well matched to learning how to relate to those things. And so there's this realization that I need to find some means of relating in a meaningful and positive way to these inevitabilities of life. And so if you find yourself so inclined, you embark on study and practice of Buddha Dharma. You embark on the Eightfold Path. As you do so, however, a very interesting phenomenon begins to happen. Because when we stop and think about how it is that we were trained to learn from a very, very early age, whether by our parents or our teachers or our employers or whoever we find ourselves, yielding up a certain amount of our power to. Generally speaking, the way we were conditioned to think and behave the way we do now is that we were rewarded by the powers that be for doing things that the powers that be wanted us to do, that we were punished for doing things that they didn't want us to do, those in authority, okay. And they didn't seem to pay much attention to us either way if we weren't either doing something that they really wanted us to do, so we get pats on the head, or doing something they really didn't want us to do, so in some way or another we get smacked around with some demerits or whatever. That way of thinking about ourselves, of thinking about how one makes one's way in the world, is pervasive. It's very, very deeply ingrained in us. And so when we undertake the study and practice of Buddha Dharma, there is this inevitable tendency, okay, it's quite a natural one, to approach it in the same way. I'm going to set up a system of rewards and punishments for myself. I'm going to decide what it means to be a good yogi. I'm going to decide what it means to be a crappy yogi. And I'm going to figure out ways to reward myself, although those seem to come few and far between, or ways to smack myself around if I don't think I'm doing a very good job. And so we do, unfortunately, tend to do a lot more of the latter than the former. And then at some point, it begins to sink in. This really isn't working. There's really something amiss with the way I'm trying to go about studying and practicing Buddha Dharma, because it said right there on the shingle, it leads to cessation of suffering, but that doesn't seem to be what's happening. I seem to be kind of frustrated. And at this point in time, trying to use the discursive mind to achieve that of which it is not capable begins to lead to some significant self-doubts. Or doubts about the Dharma, or doubts about how it's being conveyed, and you can start to feel really kind of bogged down. It is an almost universal predicament of anyone who sets forth on the Eightfold Path. It's just one of the places, there's a place in North Carolina called the Dismal Swamp, right? And there is a certain kind of dismal feeling to this when you, I don't know anyone else ever find themselves there, I don't know, it tends to be geography I'm very well acquainted with. And it is a period of, it's a stressful period when you get there. When you're exerting what you thought to be your wisest and best effort, but you seem to be encountering a lot of resistance and a certain amount of frustration. Fortunately, in Buddha Dharma, there's an app for that. And it was written about 6 centuries into the Common Era by a Chinese philosopher named Sengstang. And the text that he wrote is called the Sensen Ming. The verses on the faith mind is how it's usually translated. Stephen Mitchell translates it, verses on the mind of absolute trust. It's also translated as trust in mind. And it was a text written by somebody, Sengstang, used to be called the Third Zen Patriarch, now he's referred to as the Third Zen Elder. And his whole intention, it seems, as you read through the text, was one of seeking to address the very problems and the states of mind that come up once one really begins to seriously undertake study and practice of Buddha Dharma. And he's seeking to provide some guidance, you know, kind of pointing out when your effort, you know, can't get there from here, great cosmic joke of the Dharma, and how to soften or transmute your effort, you know, in such a way as to make it possible to come closer to or begin to really experience in some kind of deep way the essence of what the Buddha had to offer. Not clinging, letting go. So, actually before I took up or got into Buddhism, and I was looking at various, you know, really exploring various non-Western paths. First I tried out, you know, Tantric Yoga for a few years, and then I went from there to Taoism, joined a Shaolin temple and learned the martial arts, and started to pick up, you know, these 5 noble arts they talk about developing, you know, the acupressure and calligraphy and herbs, and Tai Chi, Kung Fu. Got quite grounded in and really touched by, moved by the Taoist texts and Taoist philosophy. And then from there found myself getting pretty immersed in Buddha Dharma and Theravada tradition for the most part. And as I did, I would start reading these texts and I would find that they were really resonating, a lot of things that Buddha said, with what was being said by the Taoists at about the same time in history when they had no means of being in connection with each other. And then when Buddha Dharma did make its way to, it came to China in several different forms, but when it came to China again, 5th, 6th century Common Era, it became admixed with Taoism. And so for me, the texts that came out of that admixture, the Xuan Buddhism, always had a kind of a special place in my heart, I guess. And so as I was thinking about reflecting together tonight on wise effort and on concentration, these old texts started to come to mind. And basically what the Buddha taught, what Sengstang taught, was that whether effort, concentration are skillful or not, whether they're useful or not, depends pretty much entirely on the intention underlying it. What is it that leads you to exert the effort in the first place? So this is one of the poems by kind of observations in poetic form by one of the Taoist masters, Xuanzu. When an archer is shooting for nothing, he has all his skill. If he shoots for a brass buckle, he's already nervous. If he shoots for a prize of gold, he goes blind or sees 2 targets. He's out of his mind. His skill has not changed, but the prize divides him. He cares. He thinks more of winning than of shooting. And the need to win drains him of power. He thinks more of winning than of shooting. And the need to win drains him of power. So, you know, in Zen practice, they take up archery, right? And the reason they do is as a way to embody this teaching. If you're all hung up from the outset as to whether or not you're going to hit the bullseye, you're already lost. So that practice is about coming back again and again and again, just to process, just to pay attention to what you're doing, just mindfulness in the moment. So that is sort of worth reflecting on when we look at, you know, how we think our practice is going. And the problem is, and the one that can cause the doubt and whatnot, has to do with the discursive mind having some kind of image of what it means to be enlightened, what it means to make progress, what it means to achieve spiritual perfection. And as long as that's the goal that we're trying to achieve, it ain't gonna happen. Your motor vehicle may be very efficient and effective at bringing you to this meeting and getting you back home again. It can't heal a wounded relationship. Can't help you come to terms with your own mortality. It's not what it was designed to do. And so it is with the discursive mind. It's great for accomplishing certain kinds of objectives, you know, when it becomes necessary to kind of inhabit the self, kind of like climbing into a spacesuit, you know, running around pretending to be just there, the other person, get some stuff done, great, you know. But there are certain things of which it's not capable. And one of the things the discursive self is not capable of doing is letting go of the self. There are other aspects of mind that can, but the discursive construct is not wanting it. It's like Jack Kornfield says, the self, you know, wants to be around for its own funeral. But that's not the nature of his practice. So I'd like to pause this for a moment now and ask if there's anything that I've said that you found yourself resonating with or that you have any questions about. Please. Yes, Buddha Dasa, the Thai forest meditation master, and reflecting on effort, you know, he said, it's important to learn to distinguish between wise wishes and foolish desires. So there are noble and altogether beneficial and skillful aspirations, having to do with cessation of suffering, with learning how to be kinder to yourself and others, with learning how to be more mindful in the way we speak and act and conduct our lives, you know. Those are all extremely worthy goals, you know, and the Buddha advocated them, you know, for sure. But the means by which they become attainable are simply not the same means by which we've been normally conditioned to lead our lives. And so an awful lot of Buddha Dharma is allowing that to kind of sink in, you know, to realize that how we've been conditioned all of our lives to learn and do and achieve and accomplish, okay, was great for the purposes for which those attainments were made possible. Insofar as Buddha Dharma is concerned, an awful lot of spiritual maturation is all about gradually letting go of that way of thinking and doing things, and realizing that it's simply not capable of the kinds of transformational ways of knowing that the Buddha Dharma has to offer. And so, it's in some ways, it's like we're in transit, you know, from one to the other. And the Sensen Ming, Sensen says, when you try to stop activity by passivity, your very effort fills you with activity. As long as you remain in one extreme or the other, you will never know oneness.
Do you think that that recognition, I think that the analogy of the archers are a good one, very compelling analogy, but do you think it's something that you have to learn experientially, that you cannot set a goal, oh, I'm going to become enlightened, and you have to learn experientially that you can't get there, rather than intellectually?
In my experience, yes. You know, in my first 10 years of Dharma study and practice, I probably heard the words that I'm speaking this evening several hundred times, right? And I said, oh, yes, yes, very well, I understand that. Yeah, not really. Because there was part of me that just wasn't going to let go. You know, I was totally into being there for my own funeral. You know, I want to be able to, you know, celebrate the enlightened moment, right? And there are different, you know, systems of spiritual scorekeeping in the different Dharma traditions. And one of them, the Theravada, they talk about stages of enlightenment, you know, and whatnot. And the first stage is what's called entering the stream. And one of the, sort of the, when sort of one of the kind of trick questions in there, you know, if you ask somebody if they've entered this dream, they say, oh yes, I have entered this dream. Not how it works. Because there is no I to do so, right? So it's taken us right to the edge of who we were trained to think we were all of our lives, right up until we run into this completely different way of understanding what may be going on. The more you talk and think about it, the further astray you wander from the truth. Stop talking and thinking, and there is nothing you will not be able to know. The more you talk and think about it, the further astray you wander from the truth. Stop talking and thinking, and there is nothing you will not be able to know. What's he trying to get at there? What is it? What meaning does that have for you when you hear the words?
Sit and relax and meditate.
Okay. Yeah. Good.
To calm.
Please.
There's an obstacle in the yoga tradition called doership, which I'm relating to while you're saying that. It's something I would work with. It's like when you do something and you have an expectation rather than just doing
yes.
it, just to do it. And so I had that intention to not come from doership, so I would do things and then I would find I was disappointed because it didn't turn out the way I wanted. So in the process of that, I began to discover my hidden motivations
yes.
that I wasn't aware of. So I think it's a thing of skillful means. You just work with it, and as you work with it, you begin to just, you know your own mind and see the, I think the most important thing is a lot of things are driven by our unconscious that we're not aware of, and those begin to come up and mm-hmm. bring up some awareness.
Yes, thank you. Joseph Goldstein tells a story of when he was first doing intensive practice in India, the Manendraji and Goenkaji, when he would go into town to into the market to get food. One time he was, you know, bought some fruit, and this little beggar kid came running up to him and asked him for some fruit. And so Joseph gave him an orange, and the kid just turned around and ran off. Okay. And in that moment, he realized that he was sort of expecting, you know, little kid, oh, that's a heat, thank you. Kid just grabbed the orange and ran, you know. And there was just that, you know, he'd been really watching the mind carefully for some time, and all the intentions and motivations and all that. He thought he was making this generous gesture, right? And then it turns out there was a little hook in there that he hadn't seen at all until he didn't get what he wanted out of his kid. And then it was, oh, okay, well, interesting, you know. So we can have, you know, significantly mixed motives, right? And again, one of the mind's preoccupations is with perfection, right? So we judge ourselves to be good yogis if our motives are absolutely pure, right? Instead of there still being some kind of little undercurrent, you know, a little kind of half teaspoon of meanness mixed into, you know, the recipe. That's the last thing to go, folks, in the Theravada means of spiritual scorekeeping, you know, the end stage, when someone has finally is said to achieve full and complete enlightenment, the last thought one has is, oh, I am becoming enlightened. So it's gonna go down swinging. It's gonna hang in there right till the end, right? And then that's the last thing the mind just lets go of, because it's all about letting go, you know? Which is, you know, of course, where Simstan's trying to come from. Opening stanza says, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. When attachment and aversion are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Make the slightest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. To set up what you do like from what you do not like, Simstan says, is the disease of the mind. And it's not necessarily as if we can keep that from happening anyway, right? Pretty much all about preferences. Whether it's for food or politics or anything. You know, we can find absolutely anything to like, not like, and not care about. And so all Simstan's pointing out is whenever you find the mind going to that place, there will be some difficulty. And if it's possible to experience life without immediately finding yourself falling into that trap, it's going to work better for you. As an academic, this is one of those pieces of advice that really I had to wrestle with quite a long time. Do not search for the truth. Only cease to cherish opinions. Do not remain in the dualistic state. Avoid such pursuits carefully. If there is even a trace of this or that, the mind essence will be lost in confusion. What's that about? Do not search for the truth, only cease to cherish opinions. Please.
I've had a lot of self-resentment throughout my life that I grappled with about being an introvert.
Yeah.
And felt like, boy, if I just tried harder, then I could talk to people and be like the party. You know?
Yes.
And got really stuck on the idea that I have a good intention which is to want to bond with people.
Right.
So why can't I just deliver that by being able to talk to them whenever I want to talk to them? But also, you had said something about the method. You want the method of that bonding to reflect what you've seen in the world. And I've always been rewarded for talking. You know, if I'm being quiet and all of a sudden I pipe up, oh, good job.
Yes.
And I think it's helpful to try to let go of that or try to think that there might be a different way that I don't understand where maybe my intention could be fulfilled, and just having that intention is helpful to me, but not get so wrapped up in my conceptions of how that should go.
Yeah. When we first moved to Denver, almost 30 years ago now, our younger daughter was in kindergarten and at Montview, and turned out to have an amazingly skilled kindergarten teacher. And one of our first conferences with her in the fall of that first year we were here, she's saying, well, you know, it seems that your daughter is a shy person. And at first it sounded like, you know, kind of a diagnosis of mental illness, right? You know, here's a problem we've really got to work on. And it was not that at all. She was just saying, you know, I've got all different kinds of personality types in this class. You know, some are boisterous and outgoing and whatnot, and some are shy. You know, they're not all about broadcasting themselves into the world. You know, they're about keeping their own counsel, they're about careful observation, they're about being pretty careful who they want to connect with, you know. And she was talking about it more almost as a kind of self-care, you know, and not as a personality trait that there is any problem with, right? And so, you know, that's pretty much in line with, I think, a lot of where the Buddha Dharma is coming from, which is, you know, meeting yourself where you are, you know, and really feeling some value for yourself as you are, all that you are, everything, you know, rather than getting selective about those things that are okay and those things you've really got to work on and you've really got to change and whatnot. Because again, that's a means of doing things that doesn't actually turn out to either be very effective or very kind to yourself at all. To live in the great way is neither easy nor difficult. But those with limited views are fearful and irresolute. The faster they hurry, the slower they go. And clinging and attachment cannot be limited. Even to be attached to the idea of enlightenment is to go astray. Okay, folks, what are you going to do with that? What's the key word here?
Okay, this sort of is the central struggle for me in meditation, always has been.
Yes.
There's a line by Dogen Zenji, I believe, who says, to follow the ways to study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by all things.
Yes.
Yeah. So there are essentially two practices in this tradition. One is jhanic, and the other is mindfulness. But in jhanic practice, you do forget the self. The self is dropped. But when you come out of it, it's still there.
Yes.
You know, there's that story that Jack Kornfield tells about the monk in his monastery in Thailand who was really famous for his capacity to enter samadhi and to stay there for days on end.
Yes.
And then he would come out of it and he'd be just a raging son of a bitch. You know, hollering at the dogs and throwing rocks and, you know.
Yes.
So when I say this is the central struggle for me in practice, what I want to do is to forget the self.
Yes.
And yet, when I'm practicing mindfulness, I'm not forgetting the self, not in the sense that it happens in jhana practice.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Yeah, this is a huge conundrum, you know. And what Don's referring to are states of mind, absorptive states of mind that certain form of concentration practice that allows for the temporary suppression of all the hindrances. And once the hindrances are fully suppressed, then there's a lot of energy freed up. You can kind of feel it in your body. You can find yourself in somewhat elated mind states and whatnot. And there can be this sense that, you know, you've nailed it, right? It's a real kind of natural high. And then, among other things, those are really easy states to get profoundly attached to. That's one real problem with doing that. But the real trick is what happens when you come out of the state, just as you were saying, because the Buddha didn't teach that realm of practice, which, by the way, he had a lot of difficulty mastering. He didn't teach it just as a kind of a mental trick or as a way to space out, you know, or get high whenever you want to. The whole idea behind developing deep samadhi practice is to get the mind so still and clear that it becomes a more fertile ground for insight practice. So the mindfulness is able to penetrate notions of self and just see everything in its entirety and its, in some ways, its perfection. In other words, the ability, it's what the Tibetans call unfabricated mindfulness, the ability to be completely alert and open to and accepting of all existence without the filtration of selfing, without attachments, aversions, and delusions, but just to, you know, take it all in. So that's the intention underlying teaching the jhanas. And what can unfortunately happen, and I think that was this guy that Jack's talking about, didn't quite get the memo about the second half, you know. He was obviously very good at the first, but then kind of lost something in the translation when it came to being able to move from that into deep states of mindfulness. And when you're coming out of a jhanic state, among the things that comes possible is insight into the empty nature of self, which is to say, if what the mind has done is to temporarily cease self-construction, you can actually sort of fabricate anatta, and just get the mind to where it's just not doing that anymore. And then when you come out of it, either the self can reassert itself in a big hurry, you know, which I think is unfortunately the problem with this monk, or if as you come out, sometimes you can see the mind seeking to paste the self back together again, you know, bring all the, you know, the skandhas start to assemble, and you start, it's almost as if you're like, you know, you got a piece of clay on a wheel and you're kind of starting to recraft the self. And sometimes when the samadhi is really deep, you can see that begin to happen and then relax the mind again where it doesn't. So you have insight, you gain insight into how the mind goes about crafting the self. And that's the, so I think the two paths skillfully practiced aren't divergent or not in conflict, you know. but that, I mean, one is intended to inform and enrich and balance the other. And I think for all of us, you know, no matter how long we've been on the path, there can be this, I think sometimes it's an internal tension. I think sometimes, you know, like Wes Nisker's really good at kind of making fun of it or not taking the whole thing too seriously, of perhaps temporarily or for a little while feeling that sense of emptiness and of openness and really deep peace, you know? And then comes the thought, whoa, this is really far out, right? Bam, you know? And you're right back in there again. And the self is reasserting itself. You know, I guess it's one of the comforts I take from that, you know, those descriptions of the stages of enlightenment, you know? If indeed it's true that the self is going to try with increasing levels of difficulty to keep reasserting itself throughout our lives, okay, then for me, I mean, you know, it's much easier said than done. One of the most important things to let go of on the path is the expectation that through sheer effort, we're going to be able to train the mind to stop selfing. Because that just doesn't seem to be how it works. Okay. There's so much more, it seems to be a matter of renegotiating our relationship with the selfing mind, being kinder to it, being more understanding. And there's nothing that drives the self nuts faster than non-self loving it, you know, or our ability to say, oh, here we are doing that one again, you know. Not that we can keep it from happening, but if we can be, I don't know, gentler, kinder, more loving, more humorous, just, you know, it's like, oh gosh, you know, it's like I've seen the same circus once too often, you know. Like, I remember you talking about when you were teaching Dharma out to the inmates at federal men's prison, you know, using the analogy of, you know, we're watching movies of our own making, and you know, one of the members of the inmates thought, man, I've been watching the same movie for way too long. So, yeah.
I just want to follow up with this a little bit. I'm sure you're aware of Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi and his...
Say again?
You're most likely aware of Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, you know, the... I'm not sure if I have that pronounced correctly, but he wrote a book called Finding Flow. And what he's saying in there is that that state of total absorption, where you've forgotten self,
yes,
is the meaning of life, in essence.
Okay.
That's the argument he's making. And it doesn't matter whether you get there through meditation or through creating a work of art or working on airplanes, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. What matters is the state of flow.
Yes.
When he describes flow, it sounds very much to me like practice.
Yes. Yes. And Eckhart Tolle, I think a lot of where he's coming from is about that too, is, you know, having himself found a way to live in the non-dual state.
Yeah.
If I had a hammer. there is one Dharma, not many, Singstan says. Distinctions arise from the clinging needs of the ignorant. To seek mind with a discursive mind is the greatest of all mistakes. In this world of suchness, there is neither self nor other than self. To come directly into harmony with this reality, just say, when doubt arises, not to, T-W-O. In this not to, nothing is separate, nothing is excluded. So I think in some ways this, you know, really touches on what Don was just pointing out. In this world of suchness, there is neither self nor other than self. So we use these concepts. We talk about the, and the Buddha talked about this, I making and me making. He talked about a lot, you know. Now you see it, now you don't. It's like alternating current. Which is why when people would ask the Buddha, well, is there a self or isn't there? He would say yes. Or worse to that effect, you know. Which is, he's saying, there's a self when you create one, and there's no self when you're not. The real koan for us, I think, is the one of whether or not we have control over the creation of self. And if so, who is it that has control? Is it an automatic thing, okay, right? Or is there really a big green giant head, you know, that can actually make it happen? Is selfing a completely reactive, automatic process? Or is there some intelligence? Is there some decisional factor at work when it happens? The Buddha's general sense of it, it's like sticking your finger in a sea anemone, right? That it is a reaction to certain stimuli. Self arises because it wants something or because it's afraid of something. But if you find yourself occupying the mind in which that reactivity is not present, then the creation of self becomes unnecessary. And so a huge amount of this practice is all about us learning how to carefully watch the mind. What are the conditions under which we self? What are the conditions under which aversion arises? What are the conditions under which attachment arises? What are we not seeing because we don't want to see it? And a little bit by little bit, more and more and more, as the mindfulness gets stronger, you know, then everything starts to become more clear. And we see that we do not need to be nearly as reactive as we usually are. And as we see that begin to occur, then we also begin to notice that over time, maybe the self doesn't arise quite so quickly, quite so reactively, quite so strongly. Maybe it's begun to become a little bit disempowered, a little bit slower on the trigger, a little bit less reactive. And the reason that begins to happen is because we have begun to develop trust in mind, with a capital M, right? We have begun to live Singstan's teachings, the Buddha's teachings. We've begun to learn how to trust the non-reactive, non-aggressive, non-clinging mind, that it's there for us in a way that we never even knew existed. And it's a transitional process, it's a gradual process, it's a transformative process, and it's why the Buddha taught the importance over and over again of trust in mind. Let's sit for just one moment, please. one thing, all things, move among and intermingle without distinction. To live in this realization is to be without anxiety about non-perfection.